Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network with Pepsi Max, proud sponsor of the UEFA Champions League. For the love of it.
Now, we want to point you in the direction of what should be a great event this Wednesday. It's the 20 by 20 finale event with KPMG, and it's called What Next for Women in Sport? Hashtag Think It, Ask It. So the 20 by 20 movement, I'm sure you've seen, has made a big impact. And this finale event really aims to provoke more debate to drive permanent change for women in sport. And there is a stellar lineup. Sonia O'Sullivan is going to be there. Martina Navratilova is going to be there. Ada Hegerberg is going to be there, Rachel Blackmore, Brian O'Driscoll, amongst others. And it's free to watch the event. You can register on 20 by 20's social channels if you want to get involved that way. And OTB Sports is a proud partner and supporter of the 20 by 20 movement. And we are very happy to say, to that end, Sonia O'Sullivan is with us now. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm great. I know you've lent your time to this campaign. I'm curious, the Irish bubble that we're in, how do the Australians compare when it comes to coverage of women in sport or participation?
Yeah, but I think the Australians, they kind of go through phases of it, you know. It's like they do like good moments of it. I think if there's a big event on, like when it's the women, the AFLW season is on, they get amazing coverage while it's on, but then it disappears. And then like last year they had the women's, I think it was a 2020 Cricket World Cup final was on in the MCG. You know, this was like one of the last, you know, big events with a lot of people. They were doing everything they could to fill the stadium and to set a world record for women's sporting event. So I think they do tend to go with it when, you know, when the opportunity arises. But I'm not sure they're on top of it all the time as much as we are in Ireland. I think in Ireland there definitely seems to be a greater push to get greater coverage for women in all sports. And I think, you know, we've noticed a lot of that in the past 2 years. But now I suppose the thing is to keep going now that we have highlighted athletes, you know, across many different sports. And, you know, in a way, the 20 by 20 campaign was supposed to culminate the Olympics this year and to, you know, highlight the success of Irish Olympians. But that's on hold now until next year. But even without that, you know, we have already had some great female success this year in the sports that we're able to kind of get going, you know, just to have the European Rowing Championships recently with Sunita, you know, she was defending her title and, you know, winning her second European title on top of her world title, you know, it just bodes well, I suppose, for the Olympics and, you know, things like that. I think when women are successful and they get that success, then they become ingrained in the general public's eye and they become familiar and the connection is made. And that's the big thing, I think, here is to continue to make the connection with like female sports stars and the general public and have them be, I suppose, well-known household names is that, you know, that's the greatest achievement that we can have with this campaign and to keep it going.
Who were your role models when you were coming through?
Well, I would probably say they were mainly male role models and that was because they were Irish male athletes. Marcus O'Sullivan, Frank O'Mara, Eamon Coughlin, John Tracy, you know, they were the successful Irish athletes at the time. You know, Kyle was the pioneer for women's athletics and I actually didn't ever really know what she had achieved until I met her, you know, many years later when she was out managing and coaching some of the Irish teams. So it wasn't really kind of that knowledge and information was never shared with me when I was growing up. I did often compare myself to athletes from England, like I would follow like Liz McColgan and even Zola Budd when she was running for Great Britain. And I suppose the thing there was such a huge story around her, and she was young, so she wasn't that much older than me, so I could relate to what she was doing. And she was running in the world cross country, and this was because, you know, it was something I wanted to do and to be a part of, and so you could relate to it. And I think that's the big thing, is to have the connection, the relationship of, you know, young athletes, young girls looking up to and looking at an option, something that they could maybe strive to achieve if they put in the hard work and, you know, really kind of set their mind to it.
Were you encouraged coming through, Sonia?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, everybody is encouraged. I mean, I don't know anybody who wouldn't be encouraged to continue the sport. But I suppose it helps if you, you know, taste some level of success, and then you know what that feels like. And like, you don't have to be successful all the time. You just need to taste it at some point in your young career, whatever sport that you're doing. And, you know, that feeling, you can't give that to anybody. They have to experience it. And, you know, for me, from a very young age, I won an East Cork cross country. And, you know, once you do that once, then you kind of, I suppose you believe that you can do it again, and you have the chance to go out there and do it again. And so even, you know, if it doesn't happen every week, then in your mind, you're always thinking, you know, I've got to get back up there again. And so, you know, I had, you know, different ages when I was younger, and then different school friends would have ran with me. And then as the years went on, you know, it was something that I wanted to do more than some of the others. And so I just found a way of keeping it going and, you know, looking to, can I improve? How can I be better? Going out and, you know, looking for someone to push me a bit harder, to give me, you know, more training I could do to help me to improve. So I think a lot of the, I suppose, encouragement came from within myself, because I knew that, you know, to be better, you had to train harder, you had to, you know, run more races. And so I was just trying to find a way. And I think that's, you know, a lot of things is to be successful and to achieve success, you have to find a way to make it work for you. And, you know, I think that's even related to where we are today, you know, just the whole kind of COVID situation we're in. And, you know, people just need to find a way of doing things, you know, rather than, there's a whole roadblocks being put in our way. And you have to find a way around that. And, you know, in the circumstances you're in, and you have to make it work, because there's ways to do everything. And at the moment, you know, we have to do things safely. For women, you know, you just have to find it. And for me, I often trained, you know, with whoever to train. It didn't matter if it was a man or a woman. You know, if there was people to run with, I ran with them. I didn't see it any different. You know, I just, you know, it was someone to run with.
Why running? What drew you to running in particular?
Well, I don't think there was a huge number of options of other things to do at the time. We did, you know, a little bit of sport in school, like basketball and a little bit of cricket. Not very much. There wasn't very many. This was in the 80s, I suppose. There wasn't very many options, and running was one of those things that everybody did. Everybody had a go of it. And you often would start off doing, I suppose, the community games and sprinting events and things like the long jump. And I wasn't very good at that. And then there was a few charity runs I joined in with a local milk run, where you ran, like Cove is on the Great Island, and you got to run around the island. So, you know, it was such a huge challenge on a Sunday afternoon. And there was no time pressure or anything about it. You were just going the distance. And I remember doing that, and one fella said to me, "Be pretty good at cross country." And I must have been, you know, running along nicely and not out of breath or something. And I didn't really know what that was at the time, thinking, you know, you have to run across the country, and not knowing it was just running through farmers' fields. And so I started off cross country in my bare feet, and really, you know, found, I suppose, another part of the sport, so another part of athletics that I was able to, to be successful at. And to, you know, I suppose when you're successful at all, you get more joy out of it. And I was successful individually, but also won some team medals with my friends. And, you know, that also kind of adds to the kind of the fun and the social aspect of it, which is really important when you're young and in school, to be able to share that, you know, with your friends.
What's your relationship with running now then?
I still love to run. And I still run a fair bit.
What's a fair bit in your world compared to the rest of our worlds? You're probably doing 100 miles, are you, a week?
No. It's nowhere near what I used to do. And like, if I think about it, it's kind of thing compared to what I used to do. So I run about, I can run 50 to 60 kilometers a week. So what's that, like 30 to 40 miles, I suppose. Yeah. When I used to run about, you know, average up near 100 miles. So it's normal. I say normal running, you know, it's what any normal person could do if they wanted to. And about an hour most days. And but I do vary it up a little bit. You know, I don't just go for an easy run every day. I like to challenge myself and do a few sessions. And, you know, when I was training at a high level, we didn't have any of these fancy watches, you know, to measure your time, your speed and the distance that you were running. So I've kind of got into that a bit now. And you become a little bit obsessed with that. But at the same time, I like to, you know, put in a nice podcast and head out, you know, just go for a nice, easy, enjoyable run and just to get out and get some fresh air.
Mm. It's interesting, though, there's still some gene in you that wants to be challenged and wants to be competitive. That obviously hasn't dimmed totally.
No, there's something about running, you know, that kind of, it's kind of an empty feeling that you get, like you empty yourself and you feel hungrier, you know, when you actually go out there and you push yourself a little bit harder. And, you know, that you would miss a lot, I suppose, from not competing at a high level. And so to do that on a lower level, you know, that definitely gives me, I suppose, the endorphins that I need to kind of, you know, make you feel good about the day. And, you know, I always say that, you know, it takes energy to go running, but you feel so much more energized after you've run. It's something that, you know, I try to hold on to for as long as I can.
You seem to have had no problem with discipline, clearly, when you were competing. But even I remember in 2011, I was part of this little group of journalists that you were showing around London. You were chef de mission for the Olympics, and we stopped off for lunch. There were maybe 20 of us. I wasn't at your table, but somebody who was at your table was telling me that, you know, all the journalists loving free food got dinner, chips on the side and dessert as well. And in amongst it all, you were having your soup and just soup. And I thought, that's habit of a lifetime stuff there. Are you still regimented and disciplined about your diet?
I suppose I am. It kind of is ingrained in you, you know. I mean, I do. I love to eat and I love cooking and everything else. But I'm very, I suppose, like anything, I'm very measured in things like that. And like my kids, they give me a heart sometimes, you know. If you have eggs in the morning and, you know, they're making things in the afternoon, I said, I know, we had eggs already today. And they're like, have them again. Or, you know, you had like carbohydrates already. So I suppose there's always something in your head is always thinking like that. And it's different now. It's more for a health and fitness and just kind of balanced, like what I see as, you know, balanced diet and balanced kind of, I suppose it's what allows me to feel good, you know.
And, yes. Okay. So if you pick out on a Saturday night on the couch with Domino's and dessert, does the retribution begin the next morning with a run? Yeah.
Oh, there's always a run the next day, but I know for me it would be a few squares of chocolate, you know, and maybe some nice ice cream. I don't know about the Domino's. I'd rather make my own pizza.
You're dead right. Do you miss having high level competition and the pursuit of all that came with it, this dominant aspect to your life? Do you miss that kind of centrality that gave you? Does it not that your life would lack purpose by any means, but by comparison, can it feel that way?
Well, I think that there probably was a time when I did miss it, but I think I'm, you know, I'm gone beyond that now. And I found, like, there was a time when, for me, running, it didn't have a purpose and I didn't enjoy it as much, kind of when I first, you know, stopped competing at a high level. And then I realized that, you know, you don't have to be competing at that high level to enjoy it and to have running and athletics in your life. And even, you know, watching athletics and supporting it and, you know, being a part of it, covering it on RTE or on, you know, writing about it in the newspaper, talking in the radio, you know, it will be part of my life forever. And, you know, there's a certain time when you kind of feel like you don't belong anymore, that you've kind of, you've served your purpose. And then I learned that, yeah, no, I served my purpose at that high level, but, you know, I can still be involved, still, you know, enjoy it at a different level. And I think it's the acceptance of that and kind of stepping away and probably looking at the sport from the outside in rather than from the inside out. There's a bit of time there where it takes you to transition, you know, from one being involved in sport to the next. And, you know, just being able to watch other people be successful and, you know, compete at a high level and to appreciate what they're doing in a way that's different to what I used to do, but to, you know, comparing to who they're competing against now and, you know, what they have to do.
There was a roller coaster aspect to your career. I mean, incredible highs, devastating lows. You tended not to do things by half, which I think, you know, made the whole country warm to you. You know, one of the many things that we kind of there for the terrible times and made the high times all that much better. With a bit of distance now, how does your career sit with you? Are you at peace with it? Are you satisfied with your career? Did you fulfill your potential?
I mean, I suppose I'm sure many athletes would be like this, but I definitely think I could have done more. I don't think, you know, you can be satisfied, you know, when things didn't always work well. And you look back and you think maybe I could have made better decisions. But I think I was a very emotional type of runner. And so by being emotional, then I made decisions based on my emotions more often than based on, you know, I suppose, you know, strategic plans, or there wasn't a lot of, you know, what would you call it? You know, perfect plan set in place all the time. I was happy to bounce around the place. And I think I enjoyed racing too much. I wasn't willing to kind of run one race, then go off and train for a few weeks and come back and run another race. And I wanted to be in the thick of the action and out there competing all the time. And, you know, that was, I suppose that was, you know, how I lived my career was racing. And I lived to race. And the training was what I did in the winter time. And, you know, oftentimes the hard training would stop in, you know, the end of June and you'd be straight into racing and then it would just be a season of racing. And I love doing that. Okay. So, you know, it's different. It's quite different these days. Now there's people plan their seasons a bit better and, you know, maybe you have to, because a lot of the races, you have to be really up for all these races because they're all at such a level and the pace is always so high. It's a very different sport now than when I was competing 20 years ago. At the same time, I watch some of the races now and I think, wow, if I had someone going out at that pace and, you know, you knew could chase times like that, I think, yeah, I definitely, you know, would have been able to run a bit faster, because in my mind, you know, I had time goals that I didn't achieve. And a lot of that was because the opportunities weren't there and the races weren't in that way. And at the end of the day, for me, when you run a race, the most important thing is to win the race. And, you know, time is a bonus. So if you're in the middle of a race and you have to weigh up chasing time at the risk of losing, then the depending on the importance of the race, then you know, winning is probably the number one priority.
Mm. And would you say it's rare or more common to be an emotional racer?
It's probably common enough, but then, you know, then depending on the type of person you are as well, like if you're not, and then you're going to do things that you want to do, not necessarily things that your coach tells you to do or okay. tells you not to do. And you'll convince your coach that this is what you want to do, even though it might not always be the right thing to do. So, you know, there were many times like that where you'd be taking a chance and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But you know, when you're of that mindset, you all think that, well, if I don't try, I'll never know. And, you know, there was definitely cases like that where, you know, even the Olympics in 2004, like I knew I wasn't going to run well. I just was so weak. I couldn't even do strides before the final, but I wasn't going to not run because, you know, I earned a place in the final. And, you know, what if magically I did feel good? You know, you have to give yourself a chance to do it. And it wasn't, you know, stopping anybody else from being in the final, me running, because if I didn't run, they're not going to bump up somebody else. So, you know, I had to line up and take the chance and, you know, hope for the best. But, you know, there was in the back of my, I just knew, you know, there was very unlikely that I was going to run well there. But, you know, at the same time, 2 weeks later, I went out and raced Durata Tulu, who had finished, I think she was third in the 10,000 meter final, and I won the race. So I knew deep down that, you know, I was fit enough to be competitive in the Olympics, but I wasn't just going to walk away and sulk about it, but I was just going to, you know, find out for myself that, you know, I definitely was ready. There was just, you know, that one kind of that cost me. And, you know, we know so much more now about washing our hands. You know, when I think about all the people's hands that you shook and, you know, hugs and kisses and everything else at, you know, those times in your life when you were so vulnerable, like, you know, you just didn't think about that. So I think, you know, if anything, this year will have taught people a lot about, you know, being able to prevent themselves from, you know, being sick at the most vulnerable times.
Yeah. I guess you can only run in your own time and with the knowledge that you have and live with the consequences. It must be horrific. You know, the Olympics come around so rarely. It must be horrific in the early stages of the race in 96 or in 04, where you know, you feel, I don't have it today. And everyone's about to find out pretty soon, I don't have it. That resignation must be just the worst, the lowest.
Yeah, I mean, I think 2004 was probably more acceptable to me. 1996 was a lot harder because there was a little bit of unknown there and probably a lot of denial as well of the kind of level of training that I pushed myself towards. You know, you kind of think when you're running the Olympics, you have to train harder and you have to do more, whereas you actually just need to do more of the same, yourself to the start line, you know, in the same shape that you were earlier, because that was good enough for the World Championships. So why wouldn't it be good enough for the Olympics? But the Olympics all of a sudden just changes the goalposts for everybody. And the, I suppose the expectations and the pressures are that much greater. And even if you don't think you feel that, it is around the place and you know that everybody's watching. So you need to improve yourself that bit more. But yeah, no, it was, even back on that, it's, you know, it's something I like to kind of skip over a lot. And, you know, like anything, you like to talk about the good times. But then when I do think about it, you always learn from your mistakes as well. And, you know, you hope that you can use those lessons in later life and in when you have to make decisions further down the track. And even, you know, not in an athletic sense, but just in a life sense, to kind of, I suppose, take your time before making decisions rather than always jumping in with what you think is the right thing to do.
Mm. Do you think you'd be a happier person day to day now, a more contented person day to day now, if you had a gold medal, an Olympic gold medal?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it would be, but I suppose there's no doubt you would be. You'd probably be invited to a lot more things. And but oftentimes I hear people refer to me as the Olympic gold medal and I don't correct them. I just leave it on. But I mean, at the end of the day, probably no, it probably wouldn't make that much of a difference.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would probably add more things to your life that you'd be expected to do. Yeah, there's no doubt if you had the title of Olympic champion and you have that for your life, that, you know, it would be a nice feeling. It would be a nice title to have. But at the same time, you know, when you walk away from your career, you don't really, your life, I suppose I like to have a, in some ways, a quiet life and to do normal things. And maybe you're allowed to be a bit more normal when you're a silver medalist than if you're a medalist.
Well, look, there's still a statue of you a few miles up the road from where you are now. So, I mean, it's not that normal.
That's quite fun. Especially when you go down there and you're like, meets it, like often if I have some friends visiting Cove and, you know, I get to show them around and, you know, where a better place to meet than at the statue. Yeah, you never fail to draw a crowd when you do that.
I'm sure. Does 93 and the World Championships and the Chinese cross your mind very often? Like lots of athletes have to live with the pain of upgraded medals or maybe not even upgraded medals at times. And, you know, the team doctor from that period has come out on ARD and pretty much said, look, all those medals are tainted. There was systematic doping. And he's on the record as saying that. Does that live in your memory much? Or do you think about that often?
Not very much. No, people ask about it, then you do think about it and, you know, you try and weigh up what you think about it. And, you know, I think back then we all knew that there was something going on that wasn't quite right. And, but we didn't really know what it was. And people were afraid to point the finger and to kind of ask too many questions. Whereas I think people ask more questions and they get more answers. And so when that was, you know, pointed out a few years ago, I never expected that, you know, the medals would come my way or anything like that. But I think the satisfaction of knowing that, you know, people were cheating and they didn't, you know, what you thought was happening at the time was happening. That's enough in some ways, you know, I mean, the record books won't say it. And, you know, I suppose generations of people will go by and it could get forgotten because there is no little asterisk or note in the record books to say that these performances are questionable. And now, you know, you see athletes running super fast times and they think, well, why isn't it possible? But I think the technology has moved on a lot, you know, in the 20 years. So, you know, people are getting advantages in different ways now, but at least there are ways that everybody can use if they need to, because it's legal. But it's not legal to, you know, secretly go and take drugs that allow you to train at a much higher level and to recover as well. So, yeah, no, it's something that's, I suppose, part of the sports history that you wish wasn't there. And it's something that never really has been, I suppose, cleared up. And there's many incidences of that down through the years, even before that time, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, when there was, you know, state-sponsored drugs in other countries, that was never fully cleared up.
Yeah. What about the present day? I mean, we mentioned 2012 there when you were involved with the Irish team. I mean, that's unfortunately emerging as one of the dirtiest games, you know, right up there with anything, with the amount of tests now would show all sorts were going on. When you watch athletics today, I suspect as a fan and with a discerning eye, are you seeing things and performances which make you uncomfortable, or do you think they are in the main possible?
Yeah, it's a hard one because you don't want the athletes to be cheating. So you watch things and you try to think that they're clean and there's better methods of training. And sometimes when you break down the times and that athletes achieve, you know, it to me, it looks achievable because it's not something that I couldn't do in the broken down pieces. But, you know, to look at the women's 5,000 meters, and so when I first ran a 5,000 meters in 1992, I think it was the first time, and it was quite a big deal for women to be under 15 minutes. And there was a couple of years and I was the only woman to run under 15 minutes for 5,000 meters because it wasn't run very often. People didn't know how to train for it. We had been training for 3,000 meters all along. And now you see world record and girl Litsinet Giddy from Ethiopia the other night ran 14:06. And, you know, it's nearly a whole minute faster in the space of, you know, less than 30 years. You know, it's fascinating, you know, that women can do that by themselves. And, you know, there's many different reasons for it, I suppose, that you could point out, and you just hope that they're all the right reasons.
Mm. Yeah. Why, where are you on the shoe technology at the moment? That's obviously a big discussion point. Has that crossed a line?
Well, you know, I think you have, at this point, you have to accept it. That, I mean, I think, you know, when people run times in these new shoes, to have them myself, particularly the road racing shoes, and they definitely help you to run faster, even in my slow state of running these days. And, you know, I think it's just technology and it's moving with the times. I mean, you just have to look at cycling and the bikes. You know, the bikes are so much lighter now than they were when Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach were going around. And I think the times that athletes are running these days are not really comparable with previous times. And I think that needs to be noted. And, you know, there's be a line drawn there and they say, oh yeah, but they were in the new era of athletics when shoes changed.
Right.
You know, there was the World Half Marathon on the weekend and people were running personal bests and national records all the way down to last place in the race. I mean, it was outrageous the number of, you know, they have these little signs after personal best, national records, area records. They were just were. And, you know, it was all down to the shoes for sure. I have no doubt about that. And it's like, do you have to say, okay, well, we just have to go with that? Or do we have to put a little motion there and say, oh yeah, but the shoes were helping that performance?
Yes. Well, listen, there was so much more we could talk to you about. Our time has come to a close. Enjoy Wednesday. It sounds like it's going to be a great event. It's great to catch up and talk to you about your career, and I'm sure we'll do it again sometime soon. Sonia Sullivan, a pleasure, like absolute pleasure to have you on the show anytime. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks very much.
The OTB Podcast Network with Pepsi Max, proud sponsor of the UEFA Champions League. For the love of it.